As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, got a hammer rung. Arsenal deep six West Ham at the London Stadium with fans streaming away like 3 o'clock on a Saturday. We pay our respects as the Gunners bring the hammers down and also salute Sheffield United, the remarkable Bruno Guimaraes and the actual magic at the Asian Cup final. Plus, blue cards versus Crouchy doing the robot. We report on football's future at a crossroads. It's the Totally Football Show. Sunday the 11th of February, and it's brand new Totally Football Show. Joining us today, Adrian Clark. Hello, Adrian.
Hello, everybody.
You're looking very happy today.
Very happy.
For reasons we'll be getting into very shortly. Michael Cox, also with us.
Hi, James.
Hi, Michael. Lovely to have you back.
Yeah, good to be back.
Good. And a very big hello to Mark Carey of the Football Tactics Podcast.
Hello, James.
You're in your Football Tactics Podcast seat today, Mark.
Yeah, I've got to keep it exactly the same. I'm left back, Michael's right back.
Nice. Okay, because you do that together, and be interesting to see how you bring that tactical nous or possibly nous even to today's. I'm genuinely not sure which it is.
It's got to be nous, hasn't it?
Is it nous? Okay.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Adrian, of course, in terms of podcasts, you're going to be doing the What the EFL. And I mentioned that, A, to give it a shout out, but also so we can crowbar in a mention of Southampton, because on Thursday we were talking about that incredible team move followed by a thunderbolt. From whatever game that was. But what have they gone and done this weekend?
Well, they were losing 2-0 at half-time to Huddersfield. Pretty terrible team in the Championship. Then they pulled it back. Then they were losing 3-2. And they end up winning 5-3. It was an extraordinary game. And it featured one of the volleys of the season, without doubt, from Joe Rothwell. He has creamed it.
Overcomes the corner. Nichols punches away and driven the goal. What a goal it is, too, from Joe Rothwell.
Beautiful goal to watch. You've got to check it out. And yeah, What the EFL will be out on Wednesday after the midweekers.
25 games unbeaten. We were talking about the Southampton way. I saw them
last week in a flesh at Rotherham, and they were a joy to watch. It wasn't just about the pretty passing and the highlights reel. They're actually really hard working, and they're a little bit like City, where they sort of, as soon as they lose it, they're at it and they win it back. They look the real deal. They're miles better than when they were in the Premier League, put it that way.
Are they better than Burnley were in the Championship last year?
That's a good question. Wow. Probably more sophisticated.
Really?
But I couldn't say they're better because they haven't won the league, have they?
Mm. Okay. That's what the EFL. Anyway, Premier League is going to be dominating the conversation today. Match day 24. A weekend that's seen, amongst other things so far, a huge win for Arsenal at the London Stadium, which sees them keep pace with Man City and Liverpool, who both won on Saturday, against Everton and Burnley. Villa had their third straight defeat at home to Manchester United. Elsewhere, Sheffield United beat Luton, blowing the relegation battle slightly ajar. There was yet another late goal from Spurs against Brighton. Yet another 3-2 defeat for Forest, this one sparked by Guimaraes' exquisite volley. And loads of other things as well, which we'll hopefully touch on, aside from the fact that Brighton have an assistant manager who enjoys cosplaying Jurgen Klopp. What did we learn from this weekend, Michael.
And the voice of Sean Dyche as well.
Does he have that?
Well, he'd lost his voice from shouting so much with the
players.
Right,
yeah.
Clearly hadn't. Yeah. I mean, quite interesting. Do you need to train your voice in kind of academy levels before you're ready to shout?
Yeah.
In a Premier League game? Because he could barely speak. It was quite incredible.
What's the point of the shouting? Because you're in a stadium of 60,000 people. Really, the only people that can hear the coach is when you're standing next to them. So a lot of that shouting was in vain, I would imagine.
I mean, in the second half of West Ham Arsenal, probably the players could hear every word. But as a former pro yourself, Adrian, can you not hear when the managers are shouting?
Not really, no. Oh. You can't really hear much, no. It's especially when it's a good atmosphere. So, all right. Yeah.
And of course, De Zerbi was away because of dental surgery.
Yeah.
So he won't be shouting much, I would suspect, for a good few days.
Particularly invasive dental surgery. Mark, anything you spotted this weekend?
Well, from that Brighton game, I thought it was interesting that Brendan Johnson finish at the end of the game. Michael and I were talking about how from the goals scored this weekend, how many we could have potentially scored as amateurs. And we mentioned that Johnson one, even though it was...
That you could have scored?
As one that we couldn't have scored, because it was quite a difficult finish, wasn't it? When you think about how much it was bouncing, and he just basically had to just make good contact. And it looked from his celebration that... he was just relieved, rather than actually thinking, I've scored the winner here.
Well, I couldn't have scored that, because I would never have got to the far stick in time, keeping up with Son on that.
But
on
he mentions this in his post-game, I mean, with the background of the fact that it hasn't been the most amazing season of his, and that chance comes to him, and he's just thinking, I've got to keep this down. But he finished beautifully.
Maybe he's worried about the celebration police. You know, they've been out in force lately, haven't they? You know, he's probably just thought, I'd better not go too far here.
It was a good finish, though.
I'm not sure how many goals were scored this weekend, but a lot. How many of them did you think you could have scored?
my original point was that the Declan Rice goal is the most spectacular goal that I can imagine scoring. Do you know what I mean? Because I think any half, if the ball's rolled into you like that, coming across, you can kind of get a nice side foot and get the curve on it. Whereas there's certain goals, I mean, I would have bottled that Johnson one without question. Mm. Some of the headed goals I thought were great this weekend. The O'Shea one was great. Mm. The Nunes one with the neck muscles. Yeah. Could never do that. But sometimes you can just get a good one contact, I think, you know?
Guimaraes?
That was a brilliant routine. Mm-hmm. And the finish was lovely as well. Because he had to kind of, it was in a way slightly awkward finish, but also very beautiful the way he did it. Mm. But he could have completely miscued that. I thought it was a brilliant goal, the first one, I mean.
Yeah, the first one, and the other one from a set piece being Cher's one, which maybe Newcastle have learnt from the way that Everton play as well, because there's something which my colleague John Muller said about the Dyche zone. When they're in that sort of situation, where they had the free kick from was quite deep. And normally you'd think in and around the halfway line, you'd play a simple pass and kind of progress up the field. But they had a deep free kick that they played into the box, got the header, I think, from Botman, and a brilliant finish from Shah as well. But it seems like, I think Eddie Howe said after the game as well, he credits the coaching staff for noticing that's a good way to score. Yeah. And I think Nottingham Forest have the worst set-piece record as well.
Oh, they do, yeah.
They do indeed. Yeah, excellent. We'll come back to that game a little bit later on. But let's kick off our coverage of Match Day 24 with that West Ham Arsenal.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
It's Ben White this time. And hit brilliantly by who else? Declan Rice, who is restrained in his celebration of a sixth goal for Arsenal.
Ooh, Benji. West Ham 0, Arsenal 6, their fourth straight victory. Their biggest ever Premier League away win. West Ham's joint heaviest home defeat ever, and all sorts of other incredible stats about this game. Here's one of the things I found really surprising watching this match. How did Arsenal twice lose to this West Ham team?
Well, I think that in the first Premier League game where West Ham won, I think it was heavily against the run of play, so to speak. And I think this is maybe comeuppance for that, because a stat which I really like from that first game was that Arsenal had 77 touches in West Ham's box, the most by a team without scoring in a Premier League game since Opta started collecting that metric in 2008-09. Yet they didn't score, obviously. And now in the game that we've just seen, 6-0 maybe suggests that across a bit of a bigger sample that they were both 2-4-0 games probably. So, yeah, it's just kind of all come at once, and they probably deserve to to get 6 points rather than three across those two games.
Yeah, the weird one was the previous one rather than this, which was after the first half hour when West Ham did what you felt they were, what you expected them to do, they just did nothing.
Yeah, the goals were so bad from West Ham's perspective. I mean, to play against Arsenal, I know Arsenal have a good set-piece record, but a side like West Ham shouldn't be conceding two goals from set pieces. They shouldn't be done over the top with a simple ball like how they conceded the penalty. It was very odd. I mean, David Moyes' sides usually have their limitations, but you don't really think of a David Moyes side getting really thrashed like that. So I thought it was quite concerning, actually. I mean, Arsenal, I thought, played good football. It kind of goes with what you said. I didn't think this was actually one of their better displays of the season. I think they played better than this and scored two or three. But, I mean, some of the finishes were fantastic. I really like the Saka one when he cut inside. He's so good at receiving the ball in that precise situation where he's moving towards the goal. Again, I mean, the defending to let him inside was pretty poor. But his goal-scoring return really is starting to be really impressive now.
Arsenal received a lot of criticism for over-celebrating. Mm. We received criticism last week for under-celebrating Arsenal, ironically enough. And a little bit maybe we're doing it there by talking about how lacklustre West Ham, how little fight they... Once the second goal had gone in, it looked like they were just standing around a bit. But how magnificent were the Gunners, Adrian?
I thought it was just, supremely controlled performance. It was exactly what Mikel Arteta has been building. I just think... Take yourself back to when Arteta took the job and where Arsenal were. You know, a team that couldn't really score goals, were struggling badly to produce slick football, were very much mid-table at times. You know, early on in that first season under Mikel Arteta, it was really tough to watch. So from where they were to where they are now is incredibly different. I loved the performance. I thought it featured some pretty special individual displays. I think... The Odegaard was great. I thought I think he made seven chances, 107 accurate passes. He was class. Saka, I love that goal too, because the keeper was completely flummoxed. Because every time Saka pretty much goes far stick, doesn't he? And he just lashes it near post. It was very, very,
very
done.
On trend, Mark.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with reverse near post shots lately. I did a piece on it fairly recently, and it looks so simple when you actually see it. And Areola was just stood up. He didn't even dive because he just basically gave him the eyes, I suppose, is the old way of saying it. But it seems to be something that's on the rise in the Premier League.
Why reverse?
Well, it's as though, you know, you're shaping to go post and you just actually... suddenly reverse and contort your body almost at the extreme.
It also goes through the legs of a defender as well, doesn't it? This was great because of the keeper's reaction. He sort of took a step right and was like, oh, you've done me.
It's so satisfying to watch.
I thought Odegaard was great. Saka was superb. He had 8 shots, by the way, in that game. Love the fact that he ran in behind West Ham, which is something Arsenal couldn't have done very much since they've had Moyes as a manager. Great pass from Trossard, who's another one I would have picked out. Lovely goal. Enjoyed him as that sort of floating number 9 in the game. And obviously, you've got to mention Declan Rice. Mm. Never had 2 assists in a Premier League match, never had involvements in 3 goals. And I applaud the fact that he sort of kept that straight face after spanking one in from 30 yards. That took some doing, I'd imagine.
But he probably thought Coxie could have scored that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he could have. Yeah.
4th win in a row for Arsenal. And the 6-0 scoreline means that they've now moved level with Manchester City on goal difference. Is that huge, or is it just a little future footnote come the end of the season? Do you think, could we get to a point in May where that 6th goal becomes key?
I don't think so. I think with 3 teams battling together, I don't think so. But
do you think 3 teams are going to be battling together? So this is last Sunday. That's what we were saying. Great win against Liverpool. Bizarre goals. But are Arsenal going to be in the title race? They've backed up that performance in remarkable fashion.
Yeah, it's a good point. They're certainly so strong defensively. We know that that's going to be more likely, make you more likely to win titles or to be in a title push. I think that they're less likely to, quote unquote, bottle it as much as last season. I think that they'll take it further down the line before maybe they don't win the league. I think Man City are just ominous. But I think they'll be closer this season than last season.
Just picking up on something Coxie said about obviously West Ham being atrocious, and they were poor in the game, but... If that was City or Liverpool that produced a 6-0 spanking of West Ham, who were, 7th at the start of play? Great home record. if they'd have produced that performance, I think everyone would be turning around saying, what a team they are. Mm. Wouldn't they? I mean...
No, you're absolutely right. And yeah. What a team Arsenal were today. Yeah. And have been for, what, four games now?
I think so. Yeah, the trip to Dubai has been was perfect timing. They needed it big time.
But I think even if it was City or Liverpool, whoever they were playing, the sight of those West Ham players not challenging for balls, not going in for tackles... Even with the scoreline only, 1-2-0 down, it did feel like something was broken. And there's not been any suggestion of changes or anything like that imminent. But the fact that you then had a significant portion of the crowd at the London Stadium making for the exit before even half time, just remarkable.
It was remarkable, yes. I think everyone could see that there wasn't going to be a Newcastle-like comeback. There was no real heart in this West Ham performance, was there? The supporters gave up on their team. It's as simple as that, and they didn't have that faith. And it's difficult, I think, for that home team when they see so many empty seats in the second half. It must have been quite demoralising.
I think the thing is, if you're a West Ham fan, and I know you discussed this on Thursday with an actual West Ham fan, but to me the thing is, like, with Moyes, he's never been one for good, positive football. He's always been fairly cautious and conservative. But it's like he's not so cautious and conservative and defensive that it actually becomes like a pantomime villain thing. You know, he's not Allardyce or Pulis or Dyche or Warnock where you can really go, yeah, we're going to be, you know, the anti-hero kind of thing. It's just quite passive at times. You know, there was no sense. I mean, they played some teams in that kind of defensive-minded state would have like a big striker play long balls. They had Jared Bowen. I know Bowen's a very good player who can thrive on the break, but he was playing up against four centre-backs. I mean, Kiwior and White were the two fullbacks and then two centre-backs who scored a goal. You just couldn't really see how West Ham were going to cause them any problems.
And neither could David Moyes, apparently.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, there you go. Arsenal with that victory, staying in the mix, just behind Man City on goals scored, but 2 points behind Liverpool. City, of course, with that game in hand. City on Saturday... were held by Everton until the 71st minute before they got their first shot on target, but ended up winning 2-0 with a fine brace from Erling Haaland. Liverpool, that same day, 3-1 winners at home to Burnley. Any thoughts on those two games?
I thought the interesting thing from the Liverpool game was how good Kelleher was. He made two really good saves. It's a funny world being a backup goalkeeper because probably 50% of the time you don't see any minutes. And this is maybe the least... crucial game of Liverpool season in terms of being at home to a side who I think could well finish bottom. But they had 2 1-on-1s, Burnley, and two big saves. So, you know, come the end of the season, if it's 2 points, you know, people probably won't remember 3-1 win over Burnley. Didn't even think Liverpool played that well, to be honest. But Kelleher, yeah, he's really earned his... Everyone gets a medal now if they win the Premier League. You don't have to play 10 games. No. He's earned his.
And he's always deputised pretty well, whether it's cup games or the odd league game. He's a really good shot stopper, like Alisson, but he's really strong with his feet, like Alisson. He's really sort of integral to Liverpool's build-up when he plays as well. But yeah, I mean, on Michael's point, I know this has been spoken about on this podcast before, but Liverpool are still quite open at the back, which is then question marks over whether they'll get caught out a little bit more in the final few sort of games of the season, where you look at Arsenal and you look at Man City and their expected goals, which is key to my role as a data analyst, that in terms of expected goals, Arsenal and City give up less than one goal's worth of chances per game. Liverpool are at 1.2. So they're giving up over a goal's worth of chances every single game, which is, you know, in the crucial moments, that could play against them. So that's maybe where the question mark lies.
Okay. So for you, if there is an extraneous party in this three-horse race, it's not Arsenal, but Liverpool.
Potentially. But then you look at the other side of it, and I know a lot has been spoken about Arsenal, and they need a new strike and stuff. This game today probably suggests that they don't, and I've argued the fact that they don't anyway. But Liverpool have such a strong attacking unit as well. They've got goals coming. They had three different goal scorers across the forward line this weekend as well, that it's taking both into consideration. So maybe if they simply outscore the teams like they've done quite often, then that doesn't need to be as much of a problem.
I think when you look at the matches that Arsenal and Liverpool have played against each other this season, I think Arsenal have shaded it. They've looked the stronger team for most of those matches. So when people dare to say that Arsenal will be closest challengers to City, they often get shouted down. But right. I personally, and I know that people will say I'm a little bit biased. They'll say I've got my red tinted spectacles on, but I think Arsenal are slightly better than Liverpool, but not as good as Manchester.
They're both
City.
Playing red though, so yeah.
And this is true. This is true. By the way, two great headers in this game. Should mention that. I mean, unbelievable from Nunes. Dara O'Shea's was great, and Dara O'Shea. Did you know that he's the fifth fastest player in the Premier League?
To do what?
He's the fifth fastest player.
Oh, just in terms
to run.
Of running.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, the only faster players are Mickey van der Ven, Chidozie Ogbene, Pedro Neto, and Dominic Szoboszlai.
All there right. You go. So in the NFL, they used to do a sprint challenge, didn't they? And I think the Americans are quite good at kind of properly codifying this kind of thing. Is there such a thing in the Premier League? Do they get.
There is.
Yeah, they have cameras in the stadium to be able to quantify that.
All right.
The top speeds are measured.
Of course they are, yeah.
Yeah, so everything's measured these days.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking about having an actual race.
That's what I meant, because they used to do that. I think maybe the Pro Bowl was saying they would get the players together and
that'd be amazing.
They do that with mascots, crucially, but not players. Why not players, is my point.
I think Van der Ven would smash it, wouldn't he?
Do you think?
So quick.
Is he the fastest?
He's the fastest.
Is he?
Yeah. By quite a bit.
All right.
His top speed is 37.38 kilometres per hour.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
The next fastest is Ogbene at 36.93. So it's quite an actual big difference. But would the race be 10 yards, 20 yards, 30 yards, 50 yards, 100 yards? Then I think you get a
That's the thing. It's blown up on social media last week because of the Mickey van der Ven one. But it's different types of physicality, isn't it? Because if you want a nippy winger who's quick off 10 yards versus van der Ven's recovery pace, it's two different things of the top speed. The whole of social media last week was absolutely blown.
But no one would have realised Dara O'Shea was that fast.
I think Jeremy Doku is the fastest player I've ever seen over 3 yards.
3 yards.
I would pay to see that race. Every Premier League footballer over 3 yards. Probably a photo finish. I would think.
Excellent. All right. Well, so as you were with the top three, but emphatic stuff from Arsenal. Next up, let's have a quick word on some other things, including the other game on Sunday, which saw Man United victorious again away at Villa Park.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Hakan Afif with a chance to give Qatar the lead here in the Asian Cup. Final, Afif finds the bottom corner. And it's more magic from Hakan Afif.
Saturday saw Qatar retaining the Asian Cup with a 3-1 win in the final over Jordan. All three goals for the host nation in this triumph were penalties. I know that aroused your suspicions, Adrian, but you've seen them.
I've seen them. And
you're happy with them?
I'm happy. Yeah, I'm happy that they were.
You were particularly happy with the first one, which the scorer of all three, Hakan Afif, celebrated with a quite remarkable gesture.
Well, it took us back, didn't it? When we watched it, it was like, whoa, what just happened there?
What just happened? So he produces a player trading card, Mark, but then waves his hand and it becomes the letter S. He does magic.
He did an actual magic
He
trick.
Did actual wow. magic.
As his goal celebration. Yeah. It was extraordinary.
I need to watch this.
Yeah, you do. Michael, you've seen a bit more of this game than we have. Anything you'd like to add about Qatar and their back-to-back Asian Cup triumphs?
I mean, overall, it was quite a poor quality tournament from what I saw, but the final was really good, really open. Thought Jordan, who I knew nothing about coming into this tournament, played really well, quite unlucky to go down 3-1. I mean, I think To be fair, I think Qatar actually deserve a great deal of credit for the footballing side of things. I know we've inevitably discussed them for a decade in terms of their hosting the World Cup, but for them to win this tournament back to back in a competition that has Japan and South Korea and Australia and Iran and some very good teams, and on top of that, they haven't done what I suspected they would do when they were awarded the rights to the World Cup, which is just bus over a load of kind of Brazilians not quite good enough to get into the team. They've got lots of players born outside Qatar, particularly from Africa. But that is really what Qatar is all about. That is reflective of their population. And I mean, to be fair, they were absolutely terrible at the World Cup. I mean, just completely lost their nerve. But I mean, a side like Japan has 125 million population. Qatar's got 2.5 million. So to win it back-to-back is really impressive.
Very good. Excellent. On Sunday night, of course, it's the AFCON final, which is happening more or less as we record this. So we'll be reacting to that in our European Totally Football show, which we'll be recording actually on Monday afternoon because the Champions League's back, so we'll get that out early. Ooh, we're going to be covering some pretty big games in that European edition of the Totally Football show because this weekend saw the top two meeting in both Spain and in Germany, where Real Madrid pasting Girona 4-0 with what some are hailing as the decisive blow in the title race. And in Germany, scenes, Michael. Scenes as Bayern.
they were so good.
Bayern Leverkusen were extraordinary, no?
Yeah, I mean, it was a brilliant game. Leverkusen just a much better side than Bayern. I must admit, I'm not generally a massive Bundesliga watcher, but I love Leverkusen this season.
Right. You tweeted high praise for Alex Grimaldo, who's been one of the signings of the season. Came on a free, didn't he?
Yeah, free from Benfica. And I must say, I don't remember that. Like, the transfer didn't catch my eye at all. I didn't think about it. But, I mean, he's played 21 league games this season. He's scored 8 goals and he's got 9 assists. I don't think any of them are penalties. And some of the goals, just mad angles, mad distances. The one at the weekend was brilliant because it shows what he's all about. He's not just a touchline hugger who crosses it. He really gets into that channel. And the finish was from about 8 to 10 yards. But the amount of swerve he got on it past Neuer, it's a brilliant goal.
His technique's fantastic.
They're such a good team, Leverkusen. Really, really good team.
Third goal was fun as well. With Neuer, who bombed up the other end. And Frimpong, who you think is going to be clear through on goal, but 3 Bayern players get back. And then he pulls off. I guess it was a near post as well, that one, but not really a reverse.
Not a reverse. It did make me question why Neuer actually went up for the corner in the first place.
Exactly.
Because when you're 2-0 down, it's even if you were to score, it's just contain, maybe. You know,
I think there's almost a bit of like, you know, the macho lads like him and Müller trying to really show themselves a bit. I thought that was a bit weird. And, you know, James said earlier in relation to one of the Premier League games, could that 6th goal be crucial? I mean, that's a 2-goal difference swing. That could be crucial. I was amazed he did that. Bizarre.
Interesting. Anyway, more on that in Tuesday shows. We look ahead to the Champions League last 16 and the Europa League playoffs. Michael, sorry, just before we get back onto the Premier League, you're also about to drop a piece on the Champions League and why it's ripe for an outsider victory again this season.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think the quality of the big teams in the Champions League is probably the lowest it's been for quite a while. I mean, I think even if you just look at the Premier League, usually that's one with, or recently it's been 90 to 95 points. This will be the lowest points total almost certainly since Leicester won it. And you look at the big teams, I mean, the champions of Spain, Barcelona have dropped off completely. Champions of Italy, Napoli have dropped off completely. And when you also look at what's going to happen next year with this Swiss League thing coming on, that's going to make it even more difficult for the outsiders. So by definition, it's an outside chance that it's going to happen. But if any team is going to do like what Porto did in 2004.
Could it be Porto 20 years on?
I think PSV could be quite good, actually.
Really?
I mean, they've kind of dipped a bit, but they won their first 17 games of the season.
Yeah, 16.
16,
I think,
sorry.
It was 16.
And they're so far clear that they can afford to put their eggs a bit more into the basket.
Do you remember when they played Arsenal and they looked very one-dimensional?
Yeah, that was that's a little bit worrying. I mean, probably not a real outsider at all because they got to the final last year. But it could be a season for someone like Inter. You know, like a proper team. Because the Champions League last 10 years, I think it's been incredibly about like one individual. You know, the Benzema of Real Madrid, obviously Ronaldo, Messi, Lewandowski has just completely won games on his own. I don't see that many players capable of doing that at the moment. So many of them have gone to Saudi Arabia or to the MLS or retired. There's only one footballer in Europe who has won the Ballon d'Or, and that's Luka Modric, who's 38. Like, no one else is on that level we're accustomed to in the Champions League.
Wow.
So I don't know what will happen, but I think it will be a good one because there's a few teams like Real Sociedad, for example.
Yeah, taking on PSG.
Yeah, who could you do know, it, you know. Sometimes just a good unit, a good solid unit against PSG can do the job.
All right. This week, Man City will be taking on Copenhagen in what will be the Danish side's first match in 2 months because they're on their winter break. It's a bit of a shame because they were so much fun in the group stages. Elsewhere, you've got Bayern against Lazio, RB Leipzig host Real Madrid, and PSG against Real Sociedad. Anyway, we'll talk about that more on Tuesday. Sunday's other game, meanwhile, was Aston Villa's defeat at home to Manchester United. Scott McTominay belching from the bench, as I thought Peter Drury described it. And I thought, yeah, wise words, Peter. But anyway, coming in and scoring from a delightful Diego Dalot cross, the winning goal. Mark, you enjoyed this game.
Yeah, I thought it had quite a lot of ebb and flow to the game. I think that neither side were really truly dominant for a lot of the game. But I thought it was a good one. One thing that I did notice, which isn't truly reflective of the scoreline in the end, that I think United were getting frustrated with the fact that we know so much about Villa's high line. They always catch teams offside. And for quite a lot of the game, United just kept getting caught offside. And it was quite frustrating to watch when you just think, I likened it to the Tottenham-Chelsea game when I was speaking to Michael about it. Just start a little bit deeper and make your run a little bit sort of later. And I looked into the numbers on it, and United were caught offside 6 times in total, which was their second most of the season. And the most of the season was 9 times in their 3-2 home win against Aston Villa. Mm. So it just felt like they didn't learn from it. But of course, they won the game, so it's potentially superfluous to the story. But I do think that it was a bit of a trend of that game and the previous one.
Yeah, they had the front three to undo the high line, didn't they? So I don't blame them for trying it. You know, three quickies up there, all in good form. But we saw Højlund score at least. Yeah. It wasn't to do
Is that
with
five in five now.
Yeah, he's on fire.
Adrian, you've written a piece about last Christmas and what it brought for that Manchester United front line.
Well, that front three between them scored 3 goals before Christmas, and since Christmas, in 6 matches, they've scored 12 goals. It's extraordinary. They're having more shots. The conversion rates are sort of 40%, you know, 40-50%, whereas previously, you know, they were 10% or lower. That they're setting one another up as well. Rash, obviously not in this game, but yeah, all three have hit form at the same time. And I think that's definitely given the team a bit more of an edge. I think Manchester United, in addition, have been miles better without the ball of late. So they're winning the ball back in good areas more often, therefore releasing them earlier. So, yeah, they're heading in the right direction. I thought it was a bit scrappy at times, the game. It had 40 shots, which is extraordinary, really. Villa, for me, were probably the better team between both boxes. But the final pass, the final shot.
Onana had a good game.
Great. Yeah, he was pretty good. Yeah, he made a couple of good saves. Some were straight at him. But he definitely made a step forward, didn't he?
Some other standout moments. Douglas Luiz, after scoring the equaliser, doing that shimmy in Onana's face. Not sure what the backstory was to that. And also the kind of extended shocked face routine that Casemiro did.
It was extraordinary.
To all four corners of the stadium. Did you catch what I'm doing? I'm going to do it to you
now. It felt like it lasted almost a minute, didn't it, in terms of the shocked face. He stayed in character for a long, long time.
I guess he was very, very shocked. And when we saw the replay, we did kind of understand it a bit because he'd pulled out of the challenge with Matty Cash, for which he was...
It was a brilliant dive, wasn't it?
Brilliant dive. Cash,
yeah.
Brilliant
yeah.
dive. excellent. Okay, so the TV people announced that Man United are very much back in the top four race. Everyone happy with that? 5 points behind Villa?
I'd be surprised. Really? I must say, I still think they've got a lot of issues. I didn't think they were great defensively. I thought Villa wasted a lot of chances. And it was just McTominay to the rescue again, as he's done quite a few times. You have to give him credit. I mean, he scored 7 goals this season. He's only played 1,200 minutes. So he's scoring basically one every 2 games. But I mean, what
three for Scotland as well.
Yeah, what a weird situation. You take off Rashford and you bring on McTominay and it gives you more goal threat.
Yeah.
A very strange team, Manchester United. Haven't they still got a zero goal difference? Am I right in saying? Might have made that up. No, I haven't. Zero goal difference. 24 games into the season and we're talking about them maybe finishing top four. I still think they need to improve a lot to do that, personally.
All right, but heading in the right direction. Above them, of course, are Spurs, who reinforced their top four spot with a 2-1 victory on Saturday against Brighton. What an incredible finish this game.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke about the Johnson goal before. I think as much as anything, Ange Postecoglou will be pleased that his wide forwards are getting to the back post, because I know it's a big part of the way that he likes his teams to play. It was a massive part of the way that he likes his team to set up at Celtic. So as much as anything, I think he'll be pleased with that. And Johnson's been getting better at that. I know that he scored a goal which wasn't back post, but he came from wide against Wolves. And there was another goal that he scored this season that escapes me now. But he is starting to learn his role a little bit more and get on the end of those chances.
There's no team, I don't think, in the division that score more goals like that in terms of getting in beyond the defence. Because they create these 2v1s out wide, don't they? We saw that in this counter-attack. And they get into that sort of area where they can flash a ball across the six-yard box. And it's normally Richarlison on the end of it. And if it's not Richarlison, which he normally is, then it's the opposite winger. It's a very defined style of play. And they score. I did a piece on Richarlison and sort of highlighted how similar so many of his goals have been this season. So, yeah, they're very exciting, Tottenham. I can't deny it. They're a pretty thrilling team to watch. And what stood out for me, really, in this game was the bench.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, like, strong. Really strong. You know, Johnson comes off the bench. Son comes off the bench. Combined for the goal. You've got Basuma's on there. You know, lots of players have had a lot of first-team minutes. You know, Højbjerg, Emerson, Davis. You know, there's a lot of depth there, actually, now.
Now that players have returned from Africa Cup of Nations, Asian.
For me, they're way ahead of Manchester United in terms of what they're capable of this season.
Spurs picking up points from a losing position for the third game in their last four, which is pretty amazing, particularly for a team who have got a manager who's never managed in the Premier League before, had to deal with a bunch of absences, and had last summer sold off one of their greatest players ever.
Yeah, it is amazing. It's a great story. And yeah, they've made incredible strides. I just think that they give too many chances to the opposition to be considered in the same light as City, Liverpool and Arsenal. But yeah, I mean, they're a far better team, aren't they, this season?
Yeah, and I think that's what made the game so interesting yesterday, of just how many chances both teams gave up, because we know how they both like to play, i.e. building out slowly from the back, and both like to press really high and try and win the ball high up as well. So there was quite a lot.
There were about 1,000 turnovers.
There was quite a lot of transitional moments. And I think that, you know, just touching on Brighton, of all of the sides in the Premier League, I do feel like Roberto De Zerbi is the most, if not one of the most, dogmatic in the way that you can start to figure out how they're going to play, and you can start to then put in pressing triggers and traps to try and stop them. And Luton did it to great effect recently. Spurs did it as well. That you just think, should there be a little bit more adaptability? It's still amazing the way that they play, and when it works really well, much like Tottenham. But could they be a little bit more adaptable?
Yeah. Is that a red flag, I wonder, for him?
Yeah.
Getting, you know, making that step up to, you know, a massive club. You know, because he's clearly...
Oh, you mean in yeah.
Yeah, Deserby. I do agree with that. And Arsenal absolutely suffocated them in that performance at Emirates as well. So if you press them well, they're kind of stymied.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
Almiron's corner. Oh, it's this really short ball back to Trippier, who's whipped the cross in. Bruno! Oh! Bruno! What a lovely finish. It looked as though they got the corner all wrong, but they got it absolutely right.
The other terrifically entertaining game Saturday afternoon was a little bit later on at the City Ground, as Newcastle were 3-2 winners at Nottingham Forest. Daniel Storey pointing out that Forest have now lost 3-2 in a quarter of all their league games, which is remarkable, isn't it? Real consistency. Pretty consistent as well in their defending from set pieces, which was a problem here. Mind you, that opening free kick, and I know we touched on it before, but let's do so again, would have been hard, I think, for anyone to deal with, because it wasn't just the magnificence of the touch from Guimaraes in the outside of his boot, but the deception of the set-piece routine, yeah. Drawing everyone out and then...
It's twofold, yeah. Because it was planned, wasn't it? They've yeah. identified a weakness in their marking setup whereby they'll leave that space free at the back, or they're so man-to-man that if you all move this way, then nobody's going to be around the back. And I just think the way they manufactured it was smart. And then you look at the execution of the cross, you know, whipping it in at real pace, and then the technique of the volley. It's one of the best volleys I've seen in a long time. I mean, it reminded me a little bit of Di Canio, but obviously it didn't produce the hop and the skip, you know, with it. But it was really difficult, high degree of difficulty. And he needed it, because I don't think Bruno Guimaraes has been that great this season, really. But it's certainly a top performance from him.
Has he not been that great this season?
Probably not as comprehensive as last season.
As last time, right?
But no, he had a really good, beyond the goals he scored, a really good game.
The other thing that's becoming an issue, well, I don't know what you think, is Dan Burn at left back. Like, obviously 2 weeks running, he's been absolutely roasted, hasn't he? And you just think, I don't know how he can stop it, basically. You know, Ogbene just tore him apart, and then here it was Alanga who got in behind him once and should have scored, and then made a great run inside him, didn't he, for the goal that he did score. I just think, I don't like to say it, but I think it's curtains for Burn next season. There's no way that Eddie Howe is going to stick with him at left back. Not after what I've seen across the last couple of weeks. It's quite cruel, it's ruthless, but I think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I think teams are starting to target him a little bit more. And I know that Forest did really well in the reverse fixture of being really good on the transition. They scored a good couple of goals from that. But the alternative would be Tino Livramento, wouldn't it? And he is really good going forward, but maybe not as strong defensively. So it's kind of one or the other in terms of who do you want to go with. But ideally, if you've got the summer transfer window, you'd have someone who can do both. And I think maybe to your point, that would be the case, that that'll be where they look to strengthen.
Alrighty. Forest, who maybe were a little bit hard done by, given that there was a big shout for a penalty for 1E on Drobarevka. Would you...
No. Yeah, could have been a penalty. Could have. Probably more of a penalty than some of the other penalties that were given.
Well, on Saturday particularly, yeah. But that defeat leaves them just 2 points off the drop. In fact, four of the bottom five did lose this weekend, limiting the damage, but boosting enormously the one side that did win down at the bottom. None other than bottom of the table, Sheffield United, who, fresh from last weekend's 5-0 defeat against Aston Villa, went and beat Luton 3-1. So this was quite a surprise in many ways. It was Sheffield United's first away win of the season. It was Luton's first defeat in seven matches. Again, is it going to be huge or a footnote come May?
I think a footnote come May. I thought, yeah, this was an interesting game. I didn't watch the full game, but I watched the highlights. And I saw it was interesting to see that it was the first time that Sheffield United have gone two goals up in a Premier League game this season, which I think is just nice to see as much as anything. But I thought it was interesting because Luton, they seem to be quite open at times, and Sheffield United were able to get kind of in behind them. And I think that's quite rare for them. I know, Michael, you've seen them at home this season against more of the top sides. And is it because the onus was on them to open up a little bit, take the game to Sheffield United because Luton were the favourites in this game? I don't know, because they had 74% possession, Luton. So, the onus was on them, whereas you've seen them be so, so strong and get the ball really wide and contain big sides at home, haven't you?
Yeah, to be honest, I was going to say exactly the same, and I was going to copy what my friend who's a Luton fan said about it. He said this is the first time we've been favourites all season and our worst performance of the season. And yeah, Sheffield United were completely dominant, weren't they? And you realise, actually, we've actually got some pretty tasty players.
Yeah.
I mean, Sosa and Harmer in midfield are excellent. McAtee, I think, even when they've been poor, has been bright on the break. And Osborne, who I kind of always forget about, but he's got an eye for a pass. He's quite a good player. So that's a good four-man midfield. I mean, I don't think they're going to stay up. I think they're just too far adrift. But yeah, big blow for Luton because they've got some good results recently and also some good performances against the big teams, even when they haven't got results. Arsenal, City, but they were massively outclassed.
It was an open goal the weekend, wasn't it? Because all of their relegation rivals had really tough games. So they wouldn't have expected them to get any points. Theirs was, you know, they should be beating Sheffield United. I've watched them a few times in the flesh this season, Sheffield United, and they're not good at the back. I agree with Michael. I was going to say something similar. Really like McAtee. I really like Vinny Sousa. There's something about Cameron Archer I like. I love the fact that after missing a really easy chance, he runs through amazingly and produces a quality goal.
Reverse near post.
Yeah, reversed it into the near stick, didn't he? Yeah, it was a beauty. And Harmer's a good player. I think, yeah, these are the guys that will probably move on if and when they go down, I'd imagine. That they look Premier League players. But yeah, I think this is a sort of a rare win.
Do you think? So they remain 7 points from safety, pending any further penalties for some of the teams in that group.
Yeah.
Luton are a point clear of the bottom three with a game in hand. The other two sides in there, well, Everton, we mentioned before, defended gamely for 71 minutes but eventually lost to Man City, and Burnley had the Liverpool defeat. They're going to be having Arsenal over on Saturday, Burnley. So, we shall see. As for Everton, their next game will be on the Monday when they host Crystal Palace. That's going to be quite big because Palace are now in and around that group as well. They're in 15th, 5 points off the teams at the bottom. Huge win, though, for Brentford, who had themselves been drifting perilously close. They went to Molineux and won 2-0. That's their first win outside of West London this season.
I thought they were great as well. I watched the highlights, the extended highlights on it, and I thought that Wolves were quite poor as well, I must say. They were obviously weakened by the fact they didn't have a couple of their strongest players, you know, at the top end of the field. But Brentford pressed them really high. They're really good at sort of pinning them in. And Ivan Toney's now scored. His record is 1-2 across the whole time in the Premier League, which is... shows finish, just how strong, yeah, brilliant finish. And that's something I was going to say in terms of people might, I could be wrong, pigeonhole him as quite strong in the air, but some of his finishes across his whole time in his career have been really quite diverse. Left foot, right foot, header, the goal against Leeds where he chipped the goalkeeper, you know, comes to mind as well. But he is really diverse in his skill set, and it's obvious that the top teams are looking at him. But it's not just because he can hold the ball up well and he's strong in the air. He's really strong at all different types of finishes.
Yeah. On Brentford, just quickly, I think they'd forgotten what worked for them so well when they first got into the Premier League in recent times. And it was that, being aggressive. They were hard to play against, weren't they? They were just awkward last season. And for me, the last few months, they've been passive and soft touch, really. They haven't won many duels, you know, in the air, on the ground. And this one, it just felt like they really took it to Wolves and they caused them problems. So, yeah, fair play.
Very nice. The only other game so far this weekend was, again, on Saturday when Fulham beat Bournemouth 3-1. Many people can't work Fulham out this season, Michael. a team that can beat Forest 5-0, West Ham 5-0, lose at home to Burnley, do this to Bournemouth, which, I mean, nobody beats Bournemouth 3-1 apart from the likes of City and Liverpool, no? So who are Fulham, Michael?
I don't know. I mean, I think they're quite interesting because they got a team full of players who are just, for me, obviously not top level. I don't, with the exception of Paulinho, I don't think any of them are going to be moving to big clubs.
Right.
But they're all
William
quite,
was top level.
But they're all nice. To, yeah, for yeah. sure. But they're all nice to watch.
Right.
You know, I think Pereira is a lovely technical player. Cordova Reid always just pops up 15 minutes from the end of match of the day and scores a nice goal.
Right.
Just got nice footballers. Who's Kearney.
Who was the player who you said was top level?
Paulinho.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah. He is class. What I find interesting is that they spent $5 million on bringing in Breuer on loan, and then they don't start him, which is like feels like a little bit of a waste of money. And then the guy that's under pressure for his place gets the brace, Rodrigo Muniz. So basically, all that money they spent on Breuer has just sort of perked up the player they had already.
Well, yeah, he may prove useful down the line.
Oh no, of course he will. Yeah, I think it's a good. Breuer will add to them. I thought it might have been touch of the week. I don't know if you could have produced this touch, Michael, from Senesi.
Brilliant. How did he spin so quickly?
It was amazing, wasn't it?
Fantastic.
You got that in your locker?
Absolutely not. No. We used both feet, which is, that would flummox me to start. It was, I mean, how many goals from set pieces were there this week? Loads.
I don't know the exact number, but the amount of teams who scored from set pieces, so Manchester City, Bournemouth, Manchester United, Arsenal, Burnley, Liverpool, Brentford and Newcastle. And then the Luton and Sheffield United penalties came from corners. Mm. So I don't know when the last time that happened as well, but it just felt like it was a weekend of set pieces, yeah.
Right. No draws this weekend as well, Mark.
No draws as well, yeah. Mm. Well, on the note of Fulham as well, when you ask the question, you know, what are Fulham? I don't know whether really anyone has the answer. And I was thinking about it in terms of the equivalent of Crystal Palace, who, Michael, I know you've done a piece on recently in terms of them being consistently there or thereabouts of 12th to 14th. And I don't know, are Fulham kind of in danger, quote unquote, of doing the same? Are they going to maybe push for spending a bit more money and trying to push for Europe in future seasons? Or are they content being where they are and consolidating more for a few years? I don't know, because they've not actually been in the Premier League that long. So are the Fulham fans happy with them being consistently inconsistent? I don't know.
Well, I find out for the Fulham fans at Craven Cottage, less so for the Cherries, who are now 5 Premier League matches without a win. Excellent. The other thing from this weekend, as we await Crystal Palace Chelsea on Monday evening, that we should maybe mention is the whole blue cards for Rory. Because I missed all of this, because I follow all the wrong people on social media. Didn't know about Van der Ven being the fastest player in the Premier League or any of this stuff. So the blue cards bit is IFAB saying that they are looking at bringing in blue cards for a 10-minute spell in a putative sin bin.
For dissent or cynical fouls.
Michael, you, I think, tweeted that a piece that somebody else had written about its implementation at grassroots level and the fact that there it had been really successful.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole coverage of this has been so bad.
Okay.
I mean, it's just been completely misinterpreted, I think. The first thing to say is that sin bins have been trialled at lower levels of the non-league game for the past 4 or 5 years. The main proposal here is simply bring in a card so it's clear what that punishment is.
So the cards will be used at grassroots level for the sin bins?
Yeah.
Not in any other competition?
They spoke about potentially expanding up the leagues, but not to top level games at all. And actually, there's an interesting article that you're right. I tweeted by Philip Buckingham, one of our colleagues who did a feature on it in grassroots level. It's also quite an interesting article in the non-league paper today. Which is the best sports publication in Britain, in my opinion, where they surveyed, I think, 10 or 12 managers and referees about it. And it was actually quite a mixed reaction. It was quite interesting. Some of them thought it had been really effective and kept dissent down. Others thought it was used inconsistently, although I think you could say that about anything in refereeing. So, I mean, having looked at that reaction, I'd be reluctant to see it brought in. But I think it's worth worth dialing down our outrage.
One thing that I kind of picked out from that article was that referees saying or observers saying that you'll often have a player who's the red mist has descended and that 10-minute spell on the sidelines will allow him or her to kind of clear their head. And it did strike me that maybe in that regard, it is something that might be suited to grassroots football, but Premier League or higher levels, where TV coverage and the amount of coverage, the amount of eyes on a game kind of enforces its own policing of the way players approach, the kind of danger that at grassroots levels that referees could even be in.
I think you're right. I think the one counterpoint to that is a slight problem at non-league level has been the fact that at that level you don't have fourth officials.
Mm.
And obviously they're the best person to kind of man the sin bin.
Sin bin. So who actually runs the sin bin?
Well, the referee has to, I don't know, you know, like on your Casio watch when you can do two different stopwatches.
Right, right.
He presumably has to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'd be reluctant to see it rolled out imminently. But
okay.
It has been a little bit too much like, oh, the game's gone. Jamie O'Hara, who, I must read this tweet out. He tweeted in response, blue cards getting introduced. The game is absolutely gone. Seriously, take me back to the early 2000s. Lampard, Scholes, Gerrard, Stoke on a Tuesday night, Crouchy doing the robot. What the hell happened?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, isn't it, really?
I'm amazed that Crouch doing the robot got in there. Do you
want your tactics shows on that question?
I really didn't think Crouch doing the robot was going to come up in relation to blue cards, but there you go.
No, especially when that was rolled out at international level initially as well, rather than the first time, wasn't it, against Jamaica in the pre?
Well, I see what you mean, right? Yeah.
So he's trying to think of league football and the Premier League. I mean, the final thing I'd say on it is that in terms of the dissent side, if you really wanted to maybe kick that out for a short period of time or for a season, maybe just try and give a red card maybe for the early occasions where that would occur, and then they'd quickly stop doing
this season by doing
more yellows
for a dissent, and then as with these things generally within a week or two kind of forgotten, moved on, a bit like when you joined a gym, etc. on January.
I mean, I think the two things I was saying is that dissent is a problem in football. I think everyone accepts that, and I think it's also fair to say that with tactical fouling, the punishment doesn't fit the crime.
Right.
I don't know if this should be the punishment, but it is natural people will look for something more.
But the third problem with football, or possibly the fourth after Crouchy no longer doing the robot, would be the fact that the rules are already too complicated. Yeah. Yeah. And if anything, rather than adding new ones on top, they should strip them back. And
I don't know if they're too complicated, actually. I think they're just too open to interpretation. So, but I suppose that tallies with your point.
Get a better understanding of the actual rules now before adding new ones.
That's
my take.
Excellent. All right. Very good. But anyway, we don't have to worry about blue cards, which is a shame. So that's where we will leave today's Totally Football show. Crystal Palace, Chelsea on Monday night. Before that, we'll be recording the European Totally show. So do join us for that. Many, many thanks to Mark for joining us today. When have you got your tactics podcast?
We record every Thursday.
On Thursday.
So we'll probably be doing a review of the European games from the week and the Champions League, and all the exciting, as you say, all the exciting games from the weekend just gone.
Brilliant. Excellent. And Michael, you'll be on that as well, chair.
One last thing about the blue cards. Oh,
he can't let it go.
Do you think it's because it doesn't fit into the traffic light system?
No.
You know, if it was orange cards, people would be like, I could see where you're coming from.
That
screams police siren. Rather than
as you say, the coverage has been completely irresponsible, because even a cursory reading of the headline of the news would have enabled you to understand there was no threat of this coming in to disrupt your Super Sundays and that. But I think what there is there's a general level of frustration and a feeling that things that were once one way have been kind of shifted, almost kind of with sleight of hand. A VAR has played a big role in this, brought in as one thing, a Trojan horse. It's actually led to something quite different. So now any kind of other little kind of these IFAB, these men in suits, etc., I think there's a great deal of suspicion and a little bit of kind of, everyone's a bit stressed.
IFAB does need a bit of an overhaul, I think.
Yeah.
Why do other nations not get annoyed that there's an English, Scottish, Irish and Welsh representative? There's only 8 people on it. And we get 4 of them. And we're ruining the rules for everyone.
Who are the other 4?
I think they're just from the FIFA board.
Okay.
But I don't think it should be in our hands. We.
No, not when you look at the way we've handled other decisions of late. Okay, excellent. Anyway, many thanks to Mark and to Michael. Look forward to hearing that on Thursday. Looking forward to Tuesday's What the EFL.
We'll be on Wednesday, I think, and a handbrake off. There's going to be a lot.
Has the handbrake ever been more off than right now?
There's going to be a lot of gloating. It could be fun for gooners to listen to on Monday, but maybe Not one for non-Arsenal fans.
Well, why not get a window into Arteta's world? Magnificent. Many thanks to Charlie in the booth and you for listening. We'll be back soon. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.